As we meet for the final Sunday morning in the year 1995, it is certainly a pleasure to be here with you this morning. We are thankful for the presence of all. We are thankful for the presence of any visitors that might be here. And we hope that you have other opportunities, even this year, to come back and to be with us. But if not this year, certainly in 96, we would hope that you would come back and be with us at the times that have been appointed so that we might worship God together. If you have your New Testaments, turn with me to Philippians chapter 4. And we'll read verses 12, 13, and 14 as a means of introduction to things we want to talk about this morning. Philippians chapter 4. Beginning in verse 12, we find Paul signing off to the saints there at Philippi. He's in prison at this particular time. But the saints at Philippi, the church that he was instrumental in establishing in that city, brought great joy to him. And it's something that is recorded throughout this entire epistle, this entire book that he has written. And he writes these things beginning in verse 12 of chapter 4. I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Nevertheless, you have done well that you share in my distress. Paul here is commending the saints there at Philippi for their helping him in the work that he was doing somewhere else. And as he goes on to later to say that they once and again sent into his needs. Now that he is in prison, they're also sending and they're wanting to know of his particular condition there. So this demonstrates an attitude in Paul and also, I believe, in the Philippians that I would like to talk about this morning, an attitude that we need to develop in our life. Paul was in bonds here. He was in prison. And perhaps it was that, although I believe this is in talking about his first imprisonment, later on he was released. That even though he was in prison at this time, perhaps he was being treated poorly. The church at Philippi would have an individual there who would know about prisons, as the Philippian jailer was one of those ones that Paul was instrumental in converting unto Christ. Perhaps was a member of the church, still a member there, and he would know about the prisons and perhaps how poorly Paul was being treated. Yet in all of this, we find the outlook of Paul as being one that was cheerful, joyful, we might say even victorious. This is the time of the year when we spend, as was mentioned just a few moments ago, we spend much of our time and our thought in reevaluating our lives and thinking back over the year that we had and thinking back to the first of 95 and those resolutions that we had made and then looking through the year mentally to see if we have done those things. Thinking about that, which if there were any changes or improvements that we need to make or need to make in the next year. And wondering what we are going to do in the coming year. Nothing is more important, though, than an examination of our attitude. Our attitudes, our dispositions, especially in this, our relationship toward our Father in heaven. Toward the work and the worship that He has given each and every one of us to do. We need to examine ourselves from time to time, not only at the first of the year, but this is a good time. This is when we begin to think about those things. We need to ask ourselves, well, I start out this year, 1996, with an optimistic attitude toward the work that God has given unto me in the church, toward the worship that He requires of us. Will I be optimistic in that, or will I be pessimistic in the work? Well, I look back and look at all the failures that have gone before in the years that are past, and will I dwell upon those, or will I look at the things that have been positive about the years back and begin to think positively and optimistically about the work? Will I be content to remain as I am spiritually, or am I going to put forth every kind of effort that I possibly can to grow spiritually, to grow personally, in my faith in Jesus Christ? Will I put out every effort that I possibly can to cause the kingdom of God to be enlarged in this area by my presence, by my work, and by my worship? To a great extent, Our success in this coming year is going to depend upon what kind of an attitude and disposition we take. If we begin it with one that is pessimistic, then that's going to determine to a great extent what kind of work we're going to get done. If we have determined that it is going to be optimistic, that in the year to come we are going to be victorious in our work, then that is also going to have a large degree as to whether we will be successful or not. A defeated and a pessimistic attitude is by far the easiest one to take, isn't it? Because you just don't have to do anything. This could have been something that the Philippians had an attitude that they could have developed, that they could have been defeated. They were ones that could see Paul in prison, perhaps themselves, again, knowing the things that went on in prison. They could have held out little or no hope of his ever being released because of his being in prison and in jail. But yet they sent time and again unto him. They were requiring of his health now. They wanted to help him in every way that they possibly could. They could have taken on a defeated and a pessimistic attitude, but they did not. We can do that also. To take on this kind of a disposition takes no effort, takes no thought, takes no preparation, takes no time, does it? That, well, we're just going to kind of give up. We're going to be defeated. We're not going to put out every effort that we possibly can. I can't is easy to say, and it's even easier to do. Sometimes it's hard to say. I can't is easy to say, isn't it? It's even easier to do, because you don't have to do anything. But to take on an attitude of that of victory, of being victorious, of accomplishment, an attitude of being optimistic, this is something that has to be developed. It's something that must be cultivated in our life. It is an attitude that takes effort, thought, time, and preparation. Living a Christian life and doing the work that God has done to us to do is not an easy thing, is it? Individually or collectively, as the sign out front says, that Christ didn't say be easy. He said the reward would be worth it, but it's not going to be easy. The life of a child of God is not one. He's not promised that he is going to place us on a bed of roses and give us entrance to the pearly gates, and there's not going to be any problems at all. The road that we have chosen to walk as children of God is one that is difficult. It's one that requires a great deal of sacrifice on our part. It requires an all-out effort. I've heard an expression all my life. I don't know where it began, but I can remember as a small child someone saying to me, you don't live the life of a Christian by accident. And you don't. You don't back into it. You live it on purpose. You make an effort to do that. Rather, we find Christ saying, again, that the road is one that is difficult. And Jesus prepared his disciples for the rough road that was before them. And I believe in this, he was trying to develop the proper attitude. In Luke chapter 9, verses 57 and 58, he speaks to his disciples there. And in preparing them for the life that they had to live, he says there, the foxes have holes and the birds of the heavens have nests. But he said, the Son of Man has not anywhere to lay his head. It was not going to be easy for him. It was not going to be easy for those that would follow him. And so it is important for us to develop an attitude of one of optimism, that of being victorious. Because when we realize that in the end we are going to be victorious, we are going to be the victors, we are going to receive that crown of life. Paul made the statement in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 6 through 8, a time that he was facing death. Shortly after this, I believe, he died. But yet he said that he had fought the good fight. He had run the course. He had kept the faith. He said, there's a crown of righteousness laid up for me. He had been victorious. He had taken that attitude in his life, and he knew that when that life ended, that physical life, that he was going to be the victor. And that's an attitude that I believe he developed in his life, and one that you and I also should strive to cultivate. The importance of attitude is recognized in any field of endeavor, isn't it? I've been a coach. I've been a ball player, and I've been a coach. Some of you have also coached and been ball players. And I think you all recognize that on your team, you would want that player with an attitude that says, we're going to be victorious. None of us want that player, or want that player on our team, or player sitting beside us, saying to looking out at the other team and saying that they're just going to beat us. We don't stand a chance in this. It's the same in the battlefields. We want those soldiers next to us that are going with an attitude of being victorious, that they're going to win the struggle that they're engaged in. We don't want that man in the foxhole next to us saying that we're going to die today. We don't want that kind of an attitude with someone who is our mate, someone who is beside us. It's the same thing in the work that God has given unto us. We don't want the attitude of the other individual to be, we can't do that. It's been tried before. We want someone that is there urging us on, encouraging us, saying that there is a victory. We want to develop this kind of an attitude. We sing songs, faith is the victory. Victory in Jesus. And onward Christian soldiers, all of these set forth the attitude that we ought to develop. That is, our victory is in Jesus. We're told to put on the whole armor of God. And we are preparing for battle every day. And we're not preparing for battle against Satan in order to be defeated, but in order to win. What attitude do I display? Is it that of victory or that of defeat? Is it an attitude of pessimism or one of optimism? We want to take a few minutes this morning and look at several examples of what we find in the Bible that might be described in this way. The language of victory and the language of defeat. We should strive to cultivate the kind of dispositions and lives and attitudes that we see in men and women that were pleasing to God in the Bible. Men such as Joshua, Gideon, and David. Here were individuals that had an optimistic outview. Although it seemed that sometimes everything was against them, they knew with God on their side, they could be victorious. We want to notice one man in particular who demonstrated in his life this language of victory, of optimism. And that is a man by the name of Nehemiah, when he came to rebuilding the walls of the city of Jerusalem. We know a little bit about the history of the city of Jerusalem, and it was a very old city. Even by the time that the children of Israel came across the Jordan to occupy the promised land under the leadership of Joshua, Jerusalem was already a very old city. It was occupied by the Jebusites. May have been there at least 1,000 or 1,500 years before this time. The city of Jerusalem, we are told, could be as much as 5,000 years old from the time of today. Many people have lived there. Many nations have passed through there. Many times that city has been defeated. It has been burnt down, destroyed in some way or another, and it has been rebuilt again. One historian said that it was perhaps as many as 50 times that the city of Jerusalem was destroyed and rebuilt by different occupants that were there. The city of Jerusalem, and also the land of Canaan, that land which the children of Israel occupied, was located midway between Egypt, those nations in Africa, and also the nations there in the Mediterranean Sea, between Egypt and Assyria and Babylon, and also the Assyrian nation. It was a place where if a particular powerful nation could possess that land, then it would be a buffer between them and another nation. It was a very important trade route between these powerful nations. And this particular area was fought over many, many times. The cities destroyed, the cities rebuilt. In B.C. 606, Nebuchadnezzar captured the city while the children of Israel were living in it, and he took away some 18,000 captives. 3 years later, he went back and took away some 10,000 more. And finally, in 586 B.C., he returned to the city. He burned it down, and he carried away the remainder of the important people that were there. All these people were led away into captivity. And while Israel was held in captivity, they longed to return and to rebuild the city of Jerusalem. And notice with me some of that longing that is expressed by the children of Israel. In Psalms 137, in verses 1 through 6, we have some insight into these individuals that were captives and how much they wanted to return and they wanted to rebuild the city of Jerusalem. How much they looked back toward that time. It says, by the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hung our harps upon the willows in the midst of it. For there those who carried us away requested of us a song. And those who plundered us required of us mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her skill. If I do not remember you, let my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. If I do not exalt Jerusalem above my chief joy. Here's this kind of longing and desire that the children of Israel in captivity had when they wanted to go back and they wanted to be in the city of Jerusalem. And they remembered how that it was overrun and what happened to it. Finally, in 537 B.C., we find that Babylon fell to Persia. And that under the Persian kings, the children of Israel were allowed to go back to the city of Jerusalem. 50,000 were allowed to return to rebuild the city and to rebuild the temple. And under the leadership of those individuals, we find that partially the city was rebuilt. One of those captives was a man by the name of Nehemiah. Probably a small boy when he was taken captive. Perhaps he was even born in captivity. But he remembered something about the city or being told about the city. And he heard of the destruction and he was very, very sad of what happened to his wonderful and beautiful city. Nehemiah had done quite well under Artaxerxes. He had become the cupbearer to the king. And so he had risen in a position, God being with him, as God was with many of the captives in this time, as with Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and others. He was also with Nehemiah. Artaxerxes, as we said, was a king, and he was a relatively good king. And he wanted everybody in his presence to be happy. And so he passed a law to that effect. If you came into the presence of the king, you had to have a happy countenance about yourself. And it was under penalty of death if you did not do this. You could lose your life. This was how important it was to the king. But Nehemiah, the cupbearer, came before the king's presence one day, and he was not happy, and the king saw it. And the king inquired about his state of mind and why he was not happy. And he told him of the story of the city of Jerusalem and how much he wanted to go back there, how much he wanted to rebuild that city. We find that the king allowed him to do that. Nehemiah was allowed to return and rebuild the city of Jerusalem, given permission and given also money by the king so that this could be done. Nehemiah and the people returned to the city of Jerusalem, and immediately they began to work. And I think we find expressed in the fourth chapter in verse 6 of Nehemiah the reason why they worked so hard. It says there in that particular verse that they had a mind to work. This was their attitude. They had a mind to work. They had determined that when they got back there, they were going to rebuild the walls and they were going to rebuild the temple. They had remembered the glory. They had remembered and longed for this in their captivity. And now it was coming to fruition for them. And they were going about the work that God had given them to do. One of the things that we notice is that no sooner than they started to work, than they started to also get trouble from their neighbors and from their enemies. In the fourth chapter, in verses 1 through 3, we find there that trouble arose from the enemies. But it so happened when Sanballat heard that they were rebuilding the wall, that he was furious and very indignant and mocked the Jews. And he spoke before his brethren in the army of Samaria and said, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they fortify themselves? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they complete it in a day? Will they revive the stone from the heap of rubble, stones that were burned?" Now Tobiah the Amorite was beside him and said, "Whatever they build, even if a fox go up, he will break it down, their stone, break down their stone wall." They started getting ridicule and mocking from those that were their enemies, those that were in Samaria, who did not want to see the Jews rebuild the city nor rebuild the temple. In the second chapter, verse 19, once again, we see that they ridiculed, they laughed them to scorn, they despised us. "What is this that you are doing? Will you rebel against the king?" In the fourth chapter, once again, we even find that threats came against the children of Israel. But even this did not stop them. They had a mind to work. They were not going to be defeated. They had this attitude of optimism, of victory, and they were going to do this work. There in 4 and 11, "And our adversaries said, they will neither know nor see anything till we come into their midst and kill them and cause the work to cease." They had laid plans to come and kill the Jews because they didn't want this work to go on. And in verse 14, "And I looked and arose and said to the nobles, to the leaders, and the rest of the people, 'Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, great and awesome, and fight for your neighbors, your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses.'" Words of encouragement came from Nehemiah. "Don't worry about this. God is with us. We will be victorious." We find what they did, that the men armed themselves, and with one hand they would work, and with the other hand they would hold a weapon within their hands. In the fourth chapter in 17, "Those who built on the wall, those who carried burdens, loaded themselves so that with one hand they worked at construction and with the other held a weapon." Nothing was going to stop them from the work of rebuilding the city and rebuilding the temple. Not even the threats of their enemies coming in and trying to kill them. They were determined. Then when these enemies saw that they were determined, what they tried to do was compromise with them and get them to stop the work and talk. And in the sixth chapter, in verse 1 through 3, we find the attempts made by Sanballat and Tobias and others as they wanted the children of Israel to come down to one of the villages in the plain of Ono, and there they would talk. But even Nehemiah said, "We're not even going to stop to talk. God has given us a work and we're going to do that." They were not going to be stopped at all. Nehemiah and these children of Israel, even faced with the overwhelming difficulties that were there before them. Remember the city of Jerusalem? It was in ruins. Remember, as we talked just a few moments ago, how many times that it had been destroyed and rebuilt, destroyed and rebuilt? That wasn't going to stop them. That was not going to defeat their attitude of rebuilding this city and this temple. Even the ridicule of their neighbors and the threats that came from them, even attempts to slow down the work by talking, and thus their enemies gaining their goal, that was not going to stop them from doing what they were going to do. And why is that? It was their attitude. They had a mind to work. The children of Israel and Nehemiah had a mind to work, and nothing was going to stop them. They were engaged in a good work. And this was the attitude that they had taken on. They had this right attitude, disposition about their work, and therefore they were going to accomplish the task that was before them. Now, we can and we must be like this today. We must develop this within our life. We must cultivate this type of an attitude that we will not be defeated. This is not something that is miraculous that comes on to us. It was not miraculous for the children of Israel that they developed this. This was something that they cultivated. They had determined to do. It was no miracle work by Nehemiah, Ezra, or one of the other prophets. It's not miraculous for us today. We can develop this. We must be like this. We can see this time and time again in the children of Israel. We can see it in Joshua, as we said, in Gideon. The Lord is on our side. We can be victorious. We see it in David time and time again. We see it in Paul also in the New Testament. Here is that attitude or that language of victory that we must speak all the time as children of God. Let us note, though, in the last part of our lesson, some examples of the language of defeat. And you know, it comes in many different tongues, we might say, this language of defeat, this attitude that people take upon themselves. We can see it time and time again in examples in the Old Testament and also in the New Testament. And in noting these, then we can beware ourselves that we don't speak this language, that we speak the language of victory. We look back to the Old Testament to find an example of a man by the name of Moses. Now we think of Moses and we think, well, here's someone who was victorious. Here was one individual who for 40 years led about, maybe as some estimates say, as many as 5 million people around in a desert that were griping and complaining against him all the time for what he did and what he had done. And yet he took them there to the Jordan River and was about to take them into the land, but because of something that he did, was not able to. We would think, well, here's a man who was victorious. But if we'll notice in Exodus chapters 3 and 4, that when God called Moses, there was 5 excuses that Moses gave for God choosing someone else to do this. And if we notice these 5 excuses, and I believe there's 5 that are pointed out there, we might find that we ourselves have used these before in work that we needed to do, whether it was religious work, whether it was spiritual, or whether it was physical work. Perhaps we've used these excuses, and they're very, very old. And we find one of the things that Moses said in the very beginning was that when the Lord called him out of the burning bush, he says, who am I? In other words, who am I? Who am I that I should go and lead this great nation, the children of Israel, out of Egypt? In other words, he's saying, I'm not important enough. And he might have thought to himself, here I am, a man, 80 years old, getting on up in age now. And I'm here in Midian, and you want me to go back into a land where I'm probably still wanted for murder. Somebody might even remember me back there. And you want me to go back and lead these? Who am I? Here was the language of defeat on the part of Moses, wasn't it? Here was the language that said to God, you know, you sure you want me to do this? You sure you've got the right person? Have we used that excuse before in work? The second thing he says is, who am I? Who am I to say that sent me? Now maybe this wasn't an excuse. Maybe this was an honest inquiry. But I think as we see the attitude that developed in Moses and these other 3, I believe this was an excuse. He says, well, what's your name? Who am I to say is sending me to the children of Israel? Here again, nothing more, I believe, than another excuse, the language of defeat on the part of Moses. He then says, the children will not believe me, even though I go back. And I speak to the children of Israel, they're not going to believe me. They're not going to believe that you sent me or that I'm here to lead them out of this slavery that they are in. Then he goes on to say, I am not an eloquent speaker. Maybe he wasn't. Maybe he wasn't an eloquent speaker. Maybe he was telling the truth here. But here again we find in Moses in the very beginning when he was called the language of defeat, where he says, I'm not an eloquent speaker. Lord, you just need to find somebody else. And you know, that was his 5th excuse. That was his 5th excuse. He says, Lord, send someone else. He'd run out of excuses, we might say, and said, Lord, you just need to send somebody else rather than me. Here was the language of defeat. Here was an attitude we see in the very beginning of Moses that said, I can't do that. That work is too great for me. But he became convinced that with God on his side, he could be victorious. So in the very beginning, we have this with Moses. One excuse after another. Do we offer those same excuses sometime in work that needs to be done? Lord, send somebody else. Lord, I'm not an eloquent speaker. Lord, just, you know, are you sure you've got the right person here to do this work? We do that, I think, time and time again. And it's the language of defeat. The children of Israel, also another example in the Old Testament. You know, no sooner had they crossed the Red Sea there, where God had divided the waters, and they'd walked by on dry land, and then the sea had come in and covered the Egyptian army. No sooner had they got across that, they'd seen the wonderful miracles of God, and they begin to murmur. They begin to gripe and complain because they didn't have any water. The children of Israel were speaking out, and they were saying, Moses, you should have left us alone. We should have stayed in Egypt serving the Egyptians rather than come out here in the wilderness and die. Here again is a language that they had of defeat. They were there and they were going to die. They were out there in the desert, although they had seen over the past months the mighty miracles of God being performed, they had no more faith than to say that we're just going to stay out here and we're going to die. A language of defeat that we cannot, an attitude that we cannot cultivate and develop. In Numbers 13, we have the spies as they brought back their report from the land of Canaan, there as they were in Kadesh Barnea. And remember what the report was that they brought back? Certainly a language of defeat. They are stronger than we are. We are in our own sight as grasshoppers compared to them. We're small. They'll defeat us easily. But we know that was the report of the 10 spies, and 2, Joshua and Caleb came back and said, with God on our side, we will be victorious. That's the language that we need to develop. Not of this one that says we are grasshoppers, that they are mightier and stronger than we are. These 10 spies spoke the language of defeat. Joshua and Caleb, of that of victory. With God on our side, we will gain the victory. We find later on in the Old Testament, in Elijah, in 1 Kings 19 and 14, there he makes the statement, even I am left alone. I'm all by myself, even though there were 7,000 who had not bowed the knee unto Baal. He thought he was the only one. And he was ready to give up and ready to die. Lord, just come take my life. I'm ready to die now. He was ready to give up. But again, as we can see, 7,000 had not bowed the knee unto Baal. But he was ready to give up. Job's wife also was one, as everything had been taken away from him. She made the statement in Job 2 and verse 9, curse God and die, the language of defeat. Everything has been taken away from you. It's no use any longer. Why should you try any longer? Just go ahead and die. Here's a language, once again, of defeat. New Testament, we find a man by the name of Felix in Acts 24. As Paul is preaching unto him concerning the judgment that was to come, and he feared and he trembled at the things that were spoken by Paul, he says, when I have a convenient season, I'll call for you. The language of procrastination is a language of defeat. He says, I'll put it off to some other time. Also in the New Testament, we find the example of the one talent man in Matthew chapter 25. And when he was called before his master, what was his excuse? He says, I was afraid. I was afraid. You're a hard man, that you reaped where you did not sow, you gathered where you did not put out seed. He says, I was afraid of you. I was afraid of this situation. And so therefore I took this talent out and I buried it in the ground. And here you have what you gave unto me. A language of defeat was found within this man. Fear of failure. It's really at the heart of this kind of language, of that we can't do anything, that it's too difficult. that we will be defeated. We see again and again in both the Old and New Testament the language, as we're saying, the language of victory being spoken and the language of defeat. But as we note in every case of those who took on an attitude of being victorious, of being optimistic in the work that was given unto them, in every case, what brought on that optimism and that victory was God, knowing that they were doing the will of God. We can develop this, and we must, in our lives. Which of these attitudes do you think is pleasing unto God? Which do you think He's happy with? This attitude that says, well, we can't do it. There's no way that we can get this done. We've tried it before. Who am I? I can't do this work. Lord, send somebody else. You think He's happy with that? Or happy with the attitude that He sees displayed in Nehemiah and the people that were there? That they had a mind to work. It was a big task that was before them. But that was not going to stop them. Which attitude do you think pleases God? Well, I think we can easily see which one would be pleasing unto Him, because we see the one that would be pleasing unto us, don't we? We want to be next to that person in battle that says we are going to gain the victory. That the enemy is not stronger than the ones who are on our side. What attitude do you want? Better question is, which attitude do you have? We need to pray to God each and every day to give us opportunities so we can demonstrate the right attitude that we have toward Him and toward His work. To pray to God every day to give us opportunities to lead others unto Him, and then take advantage of those opportunities. To have opportunities to pray to help others, and then take advantage of those opportunities. When was the last time you took advantage of an opportunity? Think back in your memory over this past year. When did you have an opportunity to do good, and when did you take that opportunity to do good? Let us be like Nehemiah. Let us be like the people that were with him. Let us determine that nothing is going to stand in our way. If we have a mind to work, then we can accomplish whatever God gives us to do. Because once again, He has assigned this work to us, and He is with us in this work. Whether it be on an individual basis or whether it be on a congregational basis, we can do what God wants us to do. We can go into this battle with victory already in hand, knowing that our Lord and Savior is the victor. If you're here this morning and not a child of God, why not speak the language of victory? Why not be added to the body of Christ this morning? You have an opportunity. Don't let anything stand between you and God. Have a mind to do what God says, regardless of the difficulties that it might bring to you and to your life. Because once again, it's worth everything you have to give up. Whatever it is you have to part from in this life, it's worth it what God is going to give to you when this life is over. If you're here as a child of God and you've reproached Him in any way, you've sinned and need to seek forgiveness, and you have an opportunity this morning. The song has been selected. Won't you make your way forward? Won't you do what God says as we stand and as we sing?